Welcome to the Focus Podcast, everyone. I'm Singing Lisa, and we're continuing to bring information and people who provide great direction in the area of the coronavirus situation that we're involved in the city and, of course, around the world and its effects on our people, our communities. And we are very honored to have as our guest today, Dr. Huzar, am I saying that correct, Ali?
Dr.
Huzar Ali. Okay, and he is, Dr. Ali is a professor of medicine at LSU, an academic clinician, a clinical educator, and researcher in the section of pulmonary critical care at LSU Health Sciences Center in New Orleans. He's also worked in health administration throughout his tenure, and he's worked nationally and internationally in the field of tuberculosis and has developed programs that contribute to the education of medical students, trainees, allied health professionals, and the community. Well, Dr. Ali, thank you so much for taking time and welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You have an extensive record, which is very impressive because I feel confident in asking you questions that I know we will be able to get answers to that will help all of us in the community at least understand where we stand and what we need to know and how we can better care for ourselves and our loved ones and our friends in the community. So as we all continue to learn about the coronavirus and how it functions, we know that pre-existing conditions seem to have a very significant role in persons who are able to recover from the virus. What's involved in that process and the difficulty of it?
Well, the importance of pre-existing condition as one of the risk factors when this virus may not have an outcome that we would all desire a full recovery is based on the stage of the virus where it starts affecting the person as a pneumonia. So the risk factors for bad outcomes of this virus, which can be in about 20% of the cases, 80% of them will hopefully get better on their own or with some symptomatic treatment. But the 20% that may require escalated treatment, and by escalated treatment, I mean additional help and treatment in a hospital, such as giving oxygen or other support system, and finally ICU and ventilators. In that cohort, the patients that fall into that, generally speaking, are the ones that are elderly. Above 60 is kind of the cutoff that we have had some observations and data from China. And along with that, what we call as comorbid conditions. So the comorbid conditions can be divided into two groups. Those that are in the lung itself, so somebody say has lung disease, COPD, or some fibrosis of the lung, or underlying infection of the lung in the past, and their lung is damaged. So that's the pulmonary comorbidity. And then the non-pulmonary comorbidity would be metabolic disorders like diabetes or cardiovascular disease, or as we are seeing in our cohorts in the New Orleans, Louisiana area, would be where they are obese and they are therefore less likely to be managed successfully when they reach the phase of ventilatory support.
Mm. And so those persons that are having all of those pre-existing or any one of those pre-existing conditions obviously face an extra amount of work on the body to recover. And so is it necessarily a given that if someone ends up on a ventilator as a result of their difficulties that they cannot survive?
No, of course not. All of these are risk factors. So not all persons above 60 will have this course. Not all persons with comorbid conditions will have this course. So it's these are all observations based on statistical analysis, and there will be outliers. Similarly, not all people, all persons who are young will be immune to have this course. So they can be on both spectrums. But as a general rule, these are the risk factors that make the mortality higher in that particular cohort. Of course, once the patient is on the ventilator, and in our present data, I think we found that about 30% of the patients who are in that cohort of high risk do get on the ventilators if they get sick. But we have been able to, and we by meaning my colleagues who are in the front line, who are in the ICUs of all the hospitals in this country and in this, especially in this region, and I'm just observing what they are doing, those they have been able to successfully manage them and reduce the mortality of those patients and recover. So we have had successes with patients who have recovered from ventilator care and then have progressed to more resolution of their disease.
That is good news, because that is a critical stage when that does happen to a particular patient having extra and other complications. And so would you, for those, because I feel as if these days we've all been going back to school and getting a very quick lesson on how the body functions and all of the things that are important and to us that we may have learned very long time ago in school, but what is the primary function of the lung and its responsibilities?
I'm sorry, primary function of the?
The lungs.
Yeah, so what we have to keep in mind is not just the lung, and this is where I think it is important for me to convey what I truly believe in a professional manner. This is the virus that we are dealing with is a respiratory virus, and it's spreading through what we call as droplet infections, droplet route, which means that by coughing and sneezing in front of somebody, you could give that virus to them. Now, that is where patients who are giving this virus to others are exposing other individuals around them. That exposure can be limited if we participate in all the recommendations that have been told to us. And they include personal protection and personal safeguards and hand washing and so on, along with the distancing.
Yeah.
So the importance of social distancing is essentially to reduce the exposure. Now, after the exposure, not all of us will necessarily get the infection. The infection will be on those who are closely exposed, who are continuously exposed, and who are exposed with a large volume of that virus. So the second part of this spectrum after the exposure is the infection. When the infection occurs, it attacks the respiratory system. Let's put it that way. Now, when you and I talk about respiratory system to anybody, immediately the thought goes to the lungs. But the way I have explained in my simplistic manner to myself and to other people is this, that lung is just one part of the respiratory system. Lung, think of it like your home. As you enter the door of your house, where do you go first? You enter the first foyer. Then you go into your inner corridor. Then you go inside your room. Then you go into your bedroom. So the respiratory system is not just the bedroom, i.e. the lung. The respiratory system starts at the door. And where? What is the door of that respiratory system if you convert it anatomically? That is your upper airway, your nose, your eyes, your mouth, your face, where you breathe in all that. So that is where the respiratory system starts. And then it goes down into your throat and into your air pipes and so on and so forth. So when this virus affects, it affects the upper part first, the upper airway, as we call it, the foyer of the home, the corridor into the hallway, and so on. And that's where most of us handle it well, or will handle it well, like any other respiratory virus, flu, or any other cold virus. We and all have been exposed to that in the past. What do? We isolate ourselves if we are smart enough. We don't go to work. We tell them, hey, stay away. I love you, but I love you from far, etc., etc.
Yes.
So do all those things. And then we treat ourselves for the upper respiratory symptoms. Whatever your beliefs are, treat it with your grandmother's chicken soup, treat it with humidifiers, treat it with symptomatic treatment, treat it with whatever floats your boat that helps you treat the upper respiratory virus. That is all symptomatic treatment. And then the body kind of takes over and builds up its immunity and everything is fine. The difference between all the other viruses and this particular virus, which is called a novel COVID, is because it is A, very contagious. So the exposure to infection part is very important. And B, it is very it progresses much aggressively once it descends from the upper respiratory tract to the lower respiratory tract. And when it descends into the lower respiratory tract and passes through the air pipes and the bronchi, as we call it, assume that it's walking through somebody's hallway or corridor in his shotgun house and is trying to reach the bedroom. And it is in the bedroom, the lung, where it sits down and becomes a pneumonia. When it becomes a pneumonia, that's when it causes havoc.
Mm.
And that's where the mortality remains. And since lung, to answer your question specifically, what's the function of the lung? Well, the function of the lung is to get the oxygen out from the ambience and give it to the blood so that it can go to the body. And therefore, that gas exchange is hampered or hindered. And that causes low oxygen. And low oxygen causes respiratory failure. And respiratory failure then causes other organs to fail.
Well, thank you. That does give a great description of what is happening. And like you said, very aggressively, which I think is so shocking at times. And maybe it seems a little, I don't know if it's confusing, because sometimes it's very aggressive in some people, and even young people, it's happening very quickly and almost unseemingly without any warning at times.
That is correct. And the way, again, to understand that is this, that you get the exposure, you get the infection, and for most of us, hopefully and thankfully, you are on a plateau and you're cruising along, quote unquote, for want of a better word, although it's not cruising, you know, you are sick. But you can handle it. You can handle it in the way that your body wants to handle it, and most of us will do. And then you suddenly reach a plateau, and here comes the cliff, and wham, you go down the cliff.
Mm. Well, the news media obviously have spoken very much about the need for more ventilators, which yearly there are not many that are required. But of course, there's been a demand and a request by the president and governors and mayors as well to have many, many more made. Do we know that will be the very key part that helps people to breathe for them and then eventually on their own?
Well, that is an issue that is probably best understood in two ways. Getting more ventilators is obviously when we need it, and in any system or in any state or in any area where this is geographically a big problem, such as New York and even here, getting that is important. So depending on how many ventilators we need, we will obviously need to tap in those resources. It is my understanding that at least in this area, we are okay. But yes, down the line, we may need it. So look at it this way. If we need it, how do we know how many we need it? And no system in the world, no matter how affluent that system is can ever cope up with an unending demand. You cannot build ventilators overnight and say, here they are, and all. So therefore, that is one solution to it, that yes, let's keep our reserve, let's keep our stockpile, let's get more ventilators going, and so on and so forth. But wouldn't it be more, wouldn't it be better if we were to reduce the need of the people or the number of people who would need that?
Absolutely.
And that is the key point. How can we reduce the number of people that will go down from that cliff and require the ventilator?
Do you feel we are making headway by practicing the social distancing?
Absolutely. That is the key. That is the key to kind of identify the risks, do all the stuff that we are doing regarding personal protection, social distancing, etc., etc., and do all these common sense things as we would normally do for any other upper respiratory virus, which we have forgotten to do because we have taken all upper respiratory viruses as very simplistic and very, say, okay, we'll deal with it. Oh, it's a common cold. Oh, yeah, nothing happens, etc., etc. This one is a little different, so we better take it seriously. And yes, all those measures that we are now adopting are going to play an important part in cutting down the number of people who would ultimately require those ventilators you're talking about.
Is there a particular timeline that is followed for persons who are on ventilators? Is there a curve where you expect that by certain days or after so much use that they should show some improvement?
That is variable, and our experiences and all the data coming out from all across the world has shown that that's very variable. Again, look at it this way. Up to the point that the person is in respiratory failure, up to that point, and they have all mild disease, everybody is on the same level playing field, generally speaking, and they will get better. Once they get into respiratory failure and lung failure and other organ failure, then you get a different umbrella because it depends on how significant that failure is, what are your comorbid conditions, what are the complications that may occur, what organs are damaged, is it heart and kidney or is it some other organs, and so on and so forth. So after that, the course becomes very variable, and that's why we don't know how many of those will recover. But as I said, we have had in this, at least in this area, very good successes with a lot of so-called extubation and getting them off the ventilator. The course is after that is a little bit more prolonged, and then it becomes a kind of a marathon, and gradually the patients get better.
That's great. Well, what about people who smoke? Of course, that is an ongoing problem in any particular disease. It creates pre-existing complications, but what is your advice for those who smoke and who have lung disease?
Stop smoking, period. That's it. Simple. Two sentences. Two words.
It makes all the difference.
Yeah. If you think you're stop smoking tomorrow, do it today.
Mm. Well said.
And one cigarette or 10 cigarettes, poison is a poison. Mm.
Well said. Hopefully that message is grabbed very, very quickly. Well, your medical journey is so extensive, and I can tell that you have a passion for what you do. Was there an experience in your life that drew you to this particular field of study?
Oops. Yeah, I grew up in an environment where I was dealing with healthcare in another country, and my parents and my father my father was a pharmacist who had a pharmacy shop. So that was the environment I grew up. And that's where the inspiration and the encouragement came.
Beautiful. Well, as a nation, we've learned that we have to wash our hands. Do you feel that we have to practice better community hygiene care?
No doubt about it. I mean, we are all guilty of it, including me, that we take that in a very blasé manner and we take it for granted. We think that, our environment is much cleaner than the other environments all across the world and so on and so forth. And that is not so. Germs are germs. They have no geography, as we can see now, and they can spread, as we have heard, as we have seen now. So personal hygiene aside, environmental hygiene, community hygiene, all of those things are pretty important. And, you know, sometimes when you walk on a street in America and you find filth on the ground, that is as obnoxious as it would be in a filth in a third world country.
Yes. Unfortunately, in New Orleans, we seem to have an abundance of areas that just display that so very often and is a part of a culture that we live in. And so, you know, now the streets are clean. Everything has been swept and cleaned. And what do you see for our future? Should it just stay that way? I guess thinking about Mardi Gras and all of the other large festivals that we have, are we in danger in having those festivals?
Oh, that's a loaded question. I might get into trouble if I answer that. But no. To be realistic, we have got to continue to live our lives, but we have to live our lives intelligently.
Well,
realize the risk, and take care of it. I mean, I'm.
And better practices.
I don't mean to preach over here, and we all have to be sure that life must go on, but we must do it in a manner in which we safeguard ourselves and our community.
So what is life after the coronavirus? Will we get there, and will this be as common as the flu?
That's a question that I've always thought about a lot, and I don't know the answer. The way I have understood of it as of now, and I may stand corrected 10 minutes from now, is this. That we are dealing with a pandemic. So what's a pandemic? Pandemic means that everybody in the world are infected and are affected. That's where it is. Then there are no boundaries. That's a pandemic. I hope that by our measures that we are doing, we will convert this pandemic into some regional areas of epidemic or regional areas where there will be much more than the other areas. What we don't want is that every area on this globe is the same as, God forbid, what New York and Louisiana are or is. So convert the pandemic into some localized, controllable epidemic. After that, our goal will be to hopefully what we call as flatten the curve, as you have heard ad nauseum. And that would be that there will be a certain group of people who will have it, and that's where it will become endemic. Mm-hmm. And after that, hopefully, that once we get better measures going on, whether they are prophylaxis treatment or treatment with vaccines or prevention rather with vaccines, etc., we'll convert the endemic stage into a sporadic stage, and that is be spurts. And then somewhere down the line, we will come under the control stage. How we have controlled it. This infection will follow the same infections that we have been dealing with since the pharaohs: TB, measles, smallpox, all of those went through this route. And so we'll have to do it this way. Now, the flu is a good comparison also. That flu is there, but we have some measures. We have some prevention measures, and we have some measures to treat it. Maybe we'll reach that phase with this one too.
Yes, that is another fact that we keep hearing, that people are dying every year from the flu. And have we surpassed the number? Because most times in the news, we never hear about people who actually have died to the point that we're hearing now.
Well, the reason we are not hearing that because we have kind of established our own equilibrium with the flu. We have got those of us who take the vaccines and take it seriously. Those of us who believe they don't want the vaccine for whatever reason. Then we have the mortality with that. So that number is always there. But because we have the preventive measures and we have the treatment, we have kind of evolved our own equilibrium to live with it. Unfortunately, the difference between flu and this one is that this is much more dangerous and has higher mortality than flu. And that's is hit us much more. And it has hit us in this kind of a pandemic stage. But look at the history. If you have a chance to read the book on the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic that occurred and was as bad as this was, probably more. We are fortunate that today we have two big differences. We are more advanced technologically as well as treatment-wise. And secondly, we have the advantage of sharing all this information with the digital media and so on, meeting and talk to you than meeting you personally. And I am now conveying to you and you are conveying something without any risk, hopefully, except maybe a computer virus. I'm just kidding. You see my point? So the digital age and the social media and all the stuff advantage, the technological digital advantage that we have today and the logical advantage that we have to build vaccines fast, to make vaccines fast, to build paradigms of testing fast, they are all a big advantage. So I hope that we will do better this time than the world did in the pandemic of 1918.
Yes, advancement definitely pays off. And the other question that I have for you as we close and wrap up is that looking around at my city and looking at the people that are kind of still going about their day-to-day activities, every single person has been affected in some manner. Is there a dangerous area where the guard seems to have dropped because it hasn't hit me or my home or somebody that I know, and so I'm not as fearful or afraid?
Yes, there are. I mean, first of all, it's a mindset. What I would like to emphasize again is that the 80% of us who get this exposure to infection, we will heal ourselves. Hope you know. So the vulnerability of this disease and all is less in those persons who are out there who feel that way, and that's appropriate. That's natural. If I were a 20-year-old kid, I would say, who cares? I'll get over it. But what the younger generation has to realize, and I think most of the younger generation does that, is that they are not only protecting themselves if they do everything right and follow the guidelines, but they are also protecting the other 20% who will get this. And if they get it, they are going to encroach on the health system of the region, and that will be catastrophic. Mm-hmm. So there are pockets of. So the first is yes, the mindset of the people. As far as locales and all that is concerned, I think the regional leaders and all where this has affected have really stepped up to the plate and enforced things. And the more they enforce, the better it is. Making rules are not good enough. Enforcing them is very important. And enforcing them requires compliance by people who understand why that is needed. No, but man, Homo sapiens per se, you and I included, with are all non-compliant people by nature. You tell me something and I will rebel. That's me. We are non-compliant. But we need to understand that why are we asked to be compliant? And if I understand that, I will do it.
That is so very important. And when do you think, and I know that's hard to tell, when do we know that we've gotten some control, or we've gotten past this, or we have a grip on this, that it's safe to go outside?
I would be out of place to tell you that, because that's a modeling thing that the epidemiologists do. And it's something, but as a general answer, the thing is, first of all, we have got to make this peak come down. And once the peak starts coming down and it converts into a plateau, then it starts, after the plateau, it starts coming as a down graph, then we know we are in the right direction.
Well, I thank you so very much, Dr. Ali, for sharing so much information for us. And have we answered or asked everything that we need to pay attention to? Because I know, when should someone go to the hospital if they really feel that they are at risk? Because their symptoms seem flu-like, and then sometimes you don't see anything. You have one issue, and you're not given attention at the hospital, they send you away. How do you know to fight for your life?
Well, that's a very difficult question, and I get about 50 to 60, I deal with about 50 to 60 patients a day remotely by telemedicine or by phone. And that's a very common problem. So the way to understand is this, that, you know, you can still be ill by other illnesses other than COVID. So not all the symptoms that you are having are necessarily related to COVID. So that's the first understanding. And you take care of your own health and all your underlying health. Be sure that you are compliant with all your regular medicines and are in touch with your regular doctor for that. Then you come to the point of where you suspect that you have this infection. And there are certain telltale signs for that. So do appropriate reading and understanding of what the usual telltale signs are. And the telltale signs of that, other than having the risk of being exposed to somebody, all those external factors and external risk factors aside, because after some time, you know, as I said, you know, most of us will probably be exposed, not even knowing it. So what are the signs and symptoms that I must look for to think that I may have it? And it is generally said that if you are developing a fever, or if you're developing any upper respiratory tract symptoms that can range from sinus symptoms or running nose or cough and so on and so forth, along with fever, then that's the telltale sign. And if that happens, the best thing is to contact your doctor. And the contact has to be what I call is through the PET system, P-E-T, phone, email, or text. Don't run out and go to the emergency room or the clinic. Contact them. And today's physicians and all are very tuned to that. And all of us, or most of us, or 99% of us, are responding to that thing. So we can then decipher, listening to you, whether you should be tested or you should not be tested, etc. But whether you are tested, whether you have COVID, whether you have diagnosed COVID, or you have suspicion of COVID and you are still not being tested, or your test is pending, what is the common denominator that we must understand for anybody that has a little flu-like symptom, a little body ache, feels tired, has upper respiratory tract symptoms? What do you do? Well, I said, Juzar Ali, you stupid guy, that is me, not you. What do? I go home, I isolate myself, I be sure that I don't give it to anybody, and I take care of myself and wait till see where this goes, and then finally decide which way the treatment has to be.
There's also been another question that has come of an incubation period. Is there a time when you have been diagnosed that you are considered immune from having this again, or that you're safe to be around people because you've passed a certain number of days?
Yeah, so there are two things over here. One of them is that once you have once you have been diagnosed to have this, it is generally a 14-day period that is generally considered to be the period where you are still infecting others. So that 14-day period is the so-called golden rule for home quarantine as we are doing it now. Now, it may be less in some people. It may be a little bit more in others. There is some data to suggest that it may be sometimes 21 days. But as a general rule, it is about 14 days by which time the person is then considered to be quote-unquote not infected and has passed the phase of transmission and has recovered from that COVID infection. After that, whether you are develop a lifelong immunity or not, that is something that cannot be answered today because this is so new. So until we go through one cycle of this and see what goes down the line in the next 6 months, can we say, oh, this is one time done and it's now you're immune to it. As a general rule, once you get this thing, you're considered to be immune in respiratory viruses and so on, but not necessarily so.
Well, that's something else to consider. Another reason to still be cautious, but not to let our guard down. And so that's very important. And well, we're looking forward, of course, to the day that all of the work you and so many others are doing really just gives us the definition of, a vaccine. You know, we have something that will help us to better take care of ourselves. But I think overall, it's teaching us to understand how our bodies work and how much more aware we need to be in our hygiene and really in how we treat other people by being respectful to stay away if we are not well.
Well said.
Well, Dr. Ali, once again, I want to say thank you for being a guest on the Focus Show. It's just been very informing, and I do pray that we have an end to all of this soon, but thank you for your time and for everything you're doing to make this happen.
Thank you, and thank you for that invitation. I appreciate it. Thanks.
You're welcome.